Blog Talk Radio.
I am me, I am who I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit, moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. I am me, I am who I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit, moment by moment, fulfilling my own.
Fulfilling my own destiny. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the great big vast world of ours. And this is Purpose Talk Radio. And you are listening on Friday, March 23rd with your co-hosts, Cindy Freeman and Jane DeGeorge. We are going to be talking today with our guest, Kristen Lovatt, on overcoming opiate addictions. But first, we'd like to do a little bit of housekeeping things on here. And first of all, letting you know the theme song for Purpose Talk Radio is I Am Who I Am. The vocalist you just heard on there is Jillian Clark. The song is written by Jillian, Rachel Grace, and myself. You can find True Trinity at the website truetrinity.com, T-R-U-E-T-R-I-N-I-T-Y.com. Purpose Talk Radio is brought to you every Friday at 2 p.m. Central Time, noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, and 7 or 8, depending upon what time zone we're in the UK. Right now it's still 7 p.m. Next week we get to change it back to the normal time for them. And the show is brought to you with the theme and the mission of teaching you and others how to find your destiny and your purpose. In other words, our guests, our topics are about finding your purpose, how you came to achieve it, how they came to know it, and a few suggestions for yourself and how you can find your purpose. If you'd like to participate in this show, there's several ways that you can do it. The first and simplest one is to go into the chat room at the bottom of the Blog Talk Radio, Purpose Talk Radio show page, and you can type things into that for us. However, when that happens, you don't see anything that was typed in before it, and when the show is over, that chat room does disappear. So therefore, anything that's in there from the show does go away. However, the other way that you can participate in it is if you are on Facebook, go to Purpose Talk Radio Conversations. And so that would be if you're listening to it archived or live, you have the opportunity to put in messages, comment on the show, get feedback to our guests or to us. And we ask our guests to monitor the posts that we have pinned to the top of that group each week so that, you know, you can get any questions answered, et cetera, from that. Now, if you'd like to participate in the live show, and you're listening to us live, you can call in at 347-205-9074. Again, 347-205-9074. If you're on the show page, there is a Skype icon next to the phone number on the show page, and you can Skype in if you have a Blog Talk Radio account. Again, you can use the chat room. If you can find us over on email, on our Facebook page, Messenger, you can do that as well. There's any number of ways, and hopefully you will take advantage of that so that you will speak with our guest and be a part of the conversation that's here, because it is a very timely and important subject for these times in our life. So I think I've gotten everything that I need on that, and with that, I'm going to bring in our guest. Hello, Kristen.
Hello, Cindy.
Okay, and Jane's over in the background there as well.
Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
But she's not in.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know if you had heard her over there. She's a little bit away from the computer here. Perfect. So, let's see. You know, we want to make our guests feel as comfortable as possible in this. So, you know, one of the things I did ask, you know, do you have a favorite quote or a positive news story from this week that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Well, yes. I have to admit that I forgot what I sent you about the news story. But my favorite quote comes from the AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, big book, which now, of course, I just closed that on my computer, so I don't have it in front of me. But it's the acceptance statement. The short version is, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And so for me, that means if I can accept myself and my circumstances as they are, and not try and make them into something else, something I think would be better for me or for others. If I can just accept the way things are today, life is much less complicated and easier, more peaceful, which is what I like these days, peace and serenity.
Awesome. Well, cool. I doubt how you were able to get that in your life after a little bit of turmoil and trauma and drama and the whole work with came in a little bit. So, let's see. You want the longer version of that Alcoholics Anonymous piece? I do have it in front of me.
Sure.
Sent out. It's
awesome.
An acceptance. Cool. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. And it is out of the AA Big Book, page 417. So, yes, that is,
you
know, that's perfectly in line with, you know, even what we were saying with the I am who I am. You know, things happen. We're going to go through them. And somehow we have to find a way to get through it and move forward to whatever else we're supposed to be doing.
Definitely.
And then the other piece of, I think the website you sent us, I'd like to send some people to as well, which is where people are sharing some recovery stories. So if any of you folks are dealing with recovery issues right now, in addition to this show and getting a hold of Kristen along the way, the website is heroesinrecovery.com/stories. So you can find some of that, and that's, I know, one of the pieces, too, you wanted to share with us, but I happen to have it right in front of me at the moment and didn't want to lose it as well, because sometimes our computer screens just jump when we least expect them to.
Yes, I do.
And I think that it does give us the positive news story, because I think the recovery news stories are the positive news stories of every day.
Yes,
very true.
Hearing those stories makes us realize that addiction, you can overcome addiction. It doesn't have to be the end all for everybody.
Cool. So let me introduce you folks a little more officially to Kristen. You know, we like to set everybody at ease and have fun, a little bit of fun and chat before. Now we get into the little bit more heavy stuff here is what we're talking about. So we talk about screens jumping. Mine just did. So Kristen has been an RN since 1991. After losing much to alcohol and drug addiction, she turned her life around. She now works in mental health, has published a book about her stories of recovery, works with others who struggle. She has a blog, which we'll get into, and she'll tell you what that is too, focuses on the reality of the opiate problem in this country and offers real solutions. And some of that, I'm sure, is out of experience. She has appeared in news locally in the Milwaukee area, and I'm sure eventually is going to hit some national stuff at this point about opiate addiction, and on the show The Doctors for an episode on healthcare workers and addiction. She's committed to making a difference in all of our lives and in anyone that might have addictions, and helping, you know, overcome them or giving some suggestions. And, you know, and the biggest part I want to, I know, point out, though, is that any, you know, addiction recovery is the person's own responsibility. You know, they're the ones that have to make the choice. So when I say, you know, Kristen's information might help you, that, you know, we hope that that helps give you an impetus if you know someone or are someone in addiction, but that it ultimately is your own responsibility. So we just want to make sure that's covered as well. And as we discuss through this, there may be some mention of spirituality and higher powers or God and all of that. And one of the things we do focus on this show is whatever terminology, phraseology you use for your own spiritual practice, feel free to use it. We know in the 12-step programs, which will be brought up probably today, and recovery programs, higher power is very often used. So we just want to reiterate that as well at the beginning. So cool. So now we officially welcome you to the show, Chris.
Thank you.
So the first thing I like to say now, you know, this has become a mission of yours in helping people recover, as you said in the thing. You know, we'll get through some of the history and how it came about. But was there a point where you finally said, hey, enough is enough, that this is going to be my purpose now to recover and to spread this message? Or was it, over a course of time without going into, you know, all the details on it, but just was there that moment at all in time for you?
Yes, to both of those, but they came at different times. The
okay.
First, when I finally made a decision that I didn't want to live my life that way anymore, that being using alcohol and drugs, that happened the night I was in jail and I had to stay there overnight, and actually ended up there for 4 months, although I didn't know it at the time. I completely devastated and knew that I couldn't continue that way anymore for me or for my family. So that was the night that I decided I was going to do whatever I needed to do to be sober. And then when you know, I finally kind of got my act together, you know, sometime later, and was seeing a therapist, she suggested I start to write down my story, not so much for a book at the time, but just to get it out as a therapeutic tool. And once it was finished, she said, well, what do you think about publishing it? And so it was at that moment that I thought, boy, you know, my story maybe could help other people. Maybe I should do that. So I just kind of learned along the way to trust when other people gave me suggestions to maybe, you know, think about them and pray about them, and seemed like a good idea. I just kind of went with it. So that's how my purpose, I guess, came to be.
So, Chris, what kind of timeline are we talking about? Because in your bio, you mentioned 1991, and of course we're at 2018. When was this going on?
Right. So I graduated nursing school in 1991 and didn't really start. I abused alcohol through my whole college career and after that. Drugs didn't really become a problem until late 1999. And I had a minor surgical procedure and was prescribed Percocet and really liked it, which began, the next phase of my addiction. I started taking stuff from work a few years later. I don't know exactly when that was because I didn't write it down on the calendar. But sometime in the early 2000s, I started taking drugs from work, and that's when I got caught. And there were two incidents, one when I was stealing drugs from work that culminated in 2004, and then the next year in early 2005 in January, I was calling in prescriptions for myself, and they caught me doing that. That's when I spent the time incarcerated, about 4 months. And then I started writing the book probably in 2008 or 2009. Again, I didn't really note the date because I was just doing it as a writing exercise. And I published it. You know, it took me, I'm guessing, about 5 years to complete it. and then do all the editing, and the final publication was March of 2015. So it's been just over, or was it February? Might have been February. So just over 3 years ago now it was published.
So this really has been a process for you.
A long process. Yes, but I've been clean and sober since 2005, since my time in jail. So that's been 13 years now. And it feels pretty good, I must say.
Congratulations. Congratulations. That is awesome.
Thank you.
So as you're processing this and you're writing your story and you're putting this down on paper, the story, did you put your name in it? How did your family and friends react to this?
Well, initially when I knew it was going to be hard to write, and so my counselor suggested I write it in the third person so that I could kind of step away from it and look at it as a story I was writing rather than my own experience. So that was really helpful, I think, for me to be able to be completely honest in the book and, you know, put all my dirty secrets, if you will, in there. So it's written in the third person. My name is Nora in the book. And it was difficult for my family. My parents and my older daughter particularly, it was difficult for them to read. For my parents, it was more, they looked at it as, this is where we failed, you know, as they read the story. My father especially, like, oh, we should have done this better, or we should have. And my mom said, oh, I don't remember this, and I don't remember, you know, this, or I don't remember it that way. And I said, you know, I hold no ill will or resentment toward my parents at all. They did the very best that they could. And I told them that. And I said, this book is how I remember it. And as a child going through various things, you probably remember them a little different when you're, you know, 40 versus when they were happening and you were 12. So I think it was important for me to have them read it and just see how I was affected growing up by different things, and good for them to know that I don't hold any, you know, blame or anything like that towards them, but just that this is what I experienced. And they accepted that, and I think that was really helpful for our relationship. And then my older daughter, it was hard for her to read because she had gone through it all with me. She was, you know, in her teens when, you know, the worst part of it culminated, and very difficult, as you can imagine, for a teenager to have her parent go through that. So it was hard for her to read, but she too was just very proud of me and so glad that I was able to put that all down into to one place where I could just leave it, like put it in there and leave it. Although I talk about it often, I don't have to carry around the guilt and the shame and all that again anymore. I can move forward and know that I'm doing the best that I can to make up for any wrongs that I did, you know, during that time.
How powerful, and what a great suggestion to put it in the third person. And how wonderful that you could be that honest with them and have them read it and process that out with you. So that was some time ago that they read it then. So how are things with them now?
Oh, things are great. We, you know, we don't see each other often, but we're close. They only live, well, they live in Oconomowoc, so, you know, a half hour or so away. We don't see each other often. Everybody's always so busy. But we're in constant communication, email and phone calls, and we're going, you know, to a movie this Sunday together, and it's just really nice not to have all that angst anymore, just to have all of that gone and just be able to appreciate each other and spend time together and be contented with the way things are. Not only contented, but so grateful, so very grateful.
And I think that's the whole piece of recovery is, I think, in the thick of it, when you talk about, yeah, it was difficult. And I think the word difficult is probably very descriptive from what you were describing. And yet how hopeful for people who are listening to be able to say, yes, this could be difficult right now, and yet it can process out. They say addiction is a family illness, and it does affect those closest to us, and they're in it with us. And then to be able to talk through it and process through it, and then to be able to look at it from the other side with that kind of gratitude for everything that happened, and to know that you can look at it and say, I don't have to carry that anymore. So you're talking about some gifts of this process and the closeness that you have now. What other kind of gifts have you found along the way?
Well, so many. I lost so much. And when I think back to how it felt at the time, it was such a loss. And I just couldn't ever imagine like being happy again or having peace again. I just thought I had ruined everything. But through the years, as I've maintained my sobriety and worked a program of recovery actively, I've been given back so much more than I lost. And I never would have had any of that had I not gone through those difficult times. So, I mean, I have my family, my two daughters, my sister, my parents, sisters. We actually reunited with my older sister recently as well. And then also I have a husband that I met in the program who is so kind and so good to me. And we have, you know, we were able to buy a nice, beautiful home, and we get to go on vacations. And the relationships that I have with other recovering people are so special. I never had a relationship like that with anybody before recovery. They were all good friends, but not the deep spiritual friendship that I have now with so many people. It's just a miracle to me. So I've been, you know, I have physical and material things back, but so much more than that. I have a life and family and friends. I have a job that's awesome. You know, I lost my nursing license, of course, for a time, but I have that back. And it just has been one gift after another, after another. Slowly, I didn't get showered, but as I continue working, I just continue to be blessed and have so much gratitude for that.
And one of the parts of the 12-step program, the recovery, there's a whole list of promises and things that they speak of, and once people are recovered, that they get. It sounds like you've been able to get a lot of that in your recovery program, so it's really cool.
Most definitely.
So
I was just going to say, for me, the biggest, not that maybe the biggest, but one of the biggest that have dissipated is fear. I never would have admitted to having any fear back then. I was fearless. I was a single mother. I was going to do it all. Everything was great. But really, as I look back, I was full of fear. Fear of everything. I was afraid I wouldn't, you know, that I'd lose my job. I was afraid of everything. And that fear is gone. I don't worry about things anymore. Maybe a little bit. I'm human, of course, but not to that same, like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm never going to be able to make it. It's just it's an amazing feeling to know that I don't have to be afraid anymore.
Interesting. Okay, so you talk about the fear, but on the other hand, if we go back through the history of some of the things you spoke to us about, and I'd like you to speak to the audience about, is that, however, there was no fear when you were using the drugs and the alcohol, or abusing them, whichever way you'd like to phrase it, to the point of, you know, you didn't even fear incarceration, as you said, you spent time in jail. So where does that, let's back up on the story a little bit, and see kind of what brought you, you know, started this whole journey, so to speak.
Sure.
You know, I don't need you to go back to childhood or anything else, but, you know, wherever you feel comfortable studying it with us.
Yeah. I grew up with very low self-esteem. So when I went away to college and I found alcohol, it felt like a miracle. Like, this is what I've been waiting for my whole life. I feel funny. I can talk to people. I can, you know, dance. I can sing, whatever, you know. it just opened up this whole world for me. So I used alcohol often in my life when I was nervous or afraid. I realize now I had a lot of anxiety and depression that was untreated, so I treated it with alcohol. Later in life, I did get some help for the depression, not necessarily anxiety, but I did, would take antidepressants at various times throughout my life, and they were helpful. And so, you know, I'd do better for a little while, but then I'd see him better now. I'll go off the antidepressants, and then things would get bad again in my mind, like the depression and the anxiety. So once I started taking drugs from work, I mean, obviously that was an illegal act, and I knew that. But denial is such a strong, fierce thing. And I just had myself believing that nobody would ever notice. I wasn't going to get in trouble. Everything would be fine. Now, at the same time, the rational part of my brain said, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to lose everything. You're going to go to jail. But the denial part was strong enough to just kind of tell that other part to shut up so that I could continue on. And I can't explain what that denial is to people. Sometimes in talks that I've given, I kind of explain it like you're out at a restaurant eating. You've eaten a full meal and you're full. You see them wheel by the cart with a big old chocolate cake on it, and you know you don't need that chocolate cake. You're telling yourself, I'm not eating that chocolate cake. But then when they come to you and say, would you like some chocolate cake? You say, well, sure, I'll love some chocolate cake. And you eat the chocolate cake, and you feel sick, but you have to have the chocolate cake because it's chocolate cake. So I don't know if that helps or not, but it's like this overpowering, I have to have this substance in order to get through my day, my hour, whatever it is.
I think most people can relate to, you know, that, especially a lot of people do that on the holidays, or, you know, oh, we got to try everything, and then, I forgot to tell you what we're having for dessert. So I think most people can relate to that. Well, let me ask you, when you said you were taking the drugs from work, was it you thought you needed more drugs than you had in the prescription? You couldn't get the prescription that you needed? Just curious on that.
That's a good question. I never really had very many prescriptions for it, a few here and there. But I was at work one day. I worked in an emergency room. And, you know, we waste a lot of narcotics in the emergency room. And so I had, you know, a syringe of some medication. I don't remember anymore what it was. And I gave the little bit to the patient that they were, you know, that was ordered for them to have. And then I was going to throw the rest of it away. And I thought to myself, wow, I could take this. Why throw it away? It's just garbage. I'm not stealing. It's garbage. So I put it in my pocket and I took it home and took it, used it. I just remember this feeling like, oh, well, like it was a normal thing to do. Like, oh, well, I should just take this. We're just throwing it away. And, you know, that denial again that I'm not doing anything wrong because it's just garbage. And then it just progressed from there over the next few years to where I was stealing it out of the stock because I couldn't. The urge to use was so strong, I couldn't deny that anymore. And so then I had started stealing it. It didn't take long for them to find out once I started stealing it from the stock. I think it was maybe 6 months or so. Again, I didn't write the date down, so I'm not real sure, but somewhere around there until they found out. And then, you know, that began my downfall, of course, when I was arrested and charged for those offenses for stealing it. Did I answer your question? I feel like I started telling a story.
Yes, you did.
Okay.
So then along with that, because when you were in prison, it was the deterrent, but it didn't do it up front because of the denial. What would you say to somebody about
to help them have that be a deterrent?
Well, I mean, the best thing to suggest is to play that tape forward. And where is this going to lead? You know, if I had been honest with myself, there was nowhere else for that those events to lead. You can't steal forever and not have anybody notice. I mean, I suppose there's an off chance of such a thing. But if I had really played that tape out and said, if I continue doing this, I'm going to be in jail for 4 months, 6 months, whatever it would have been. I will be away from my children. I will lose my nursing license. I will lose everything. If I had played that tape out, it might have made me a little bit more open to getting help. Because the other part of my constitution is that I'm very stubborn and independent. So I don't like to ask for help. I didn't want to say, I need help from you. I can't do this on my own. I was very, I can do this. You know, I'm going to do it.
So there was no confiding in anybody else what was going on either. So there was no, like, red flags for someone close to you to even have said, hey, we better slow down here.
My family knew nothing. I had started going to a therapist. I don't remember the date, but at some point before I was caught stealing the drugs from work, I had gone because I knew I needed to stop using. The problem was, she told me, you need inpatient treatment, and I refused. I was a single mother with two kids. I said, I can't leave my children. I have a job. I can't. So she said, well, we'll try this outpatient and see how it goes. If you can't stop using, then you're going to need to go inpatient. So I proceeded then for the next few months continued doing the same thing at work and going to counseling and not telling her any of that. Because in my mind, I thought, if I can just figure out what's wrong with me, then I'll be able to stop using. Instead of, really the way it is, you need to stop using so that your mind can clear and you can deal with what the issues are that are causing you to use. So I had it a little backwards, and it didn't work backwards.
And that's a good point.
That's
a really good point for people to hear.
And I say, I'm sorry, James.
Like we said at the beginning, you know, unless you are the one taking responsibility, nobody else can make you do that. You know, counselors are bound by a code of ethics that says, you know, we can't do anything unless you're out there to harm yourself or others. Well, technically it was harm, but it's not, you know, like a suicide issue that they are bound to report. So they can't make anybody go into therapy. Which, you know, some people say, oh, yeah, sure they can. But, no, they really can't. And that's those who are not in recovery or going to therapists may not understand. Well, I see what
right.
you're saying as far as you don't want to lose your family, you don't want to admit to anybody, so then you just go on.
And I really feel if I had taken the time to go to inpatient treatment, I very well may have ended it there and not progressed. Because after that first time then, once that whole case was completed from my time at the hospital, I started working at a doctor's office as a secretary and immediately started calling in prescriptions for myself, which ultimately led to a felony and the 4 months in jail. So when I go and speak, and I've spoken at behavioral health hospitals before, and I always say to them, you know, if that was the turning point for me, you know, if I had just taken the help that was offered to me, it may have made a difference. I may not have ended up hurting my children and my parents and my sisters as much as I did and my friends. You know, everybody was so good to me. They were all so supportive. So, hindsight is 20/20, but if I can give some of that hindsight to someone now who may be having issues with using, you know, it would be take the treatment, go to treatment.
So I might have missed something as I switched phones or ears or whatever here. But so the first time you were in just an overnight, and were you still denying it at that point? Or, you know, if you, and they just fired you? Or how did that transition into a different job?
Sure. So the first case, when I was at the hospital and got caught for stealing, I was charged with 26 felonies for each vial of medication they could prove I took. But then after plea deals and all that, whatever, because I'd never been in trouble before, I'd never even had a speeding ticket, they gave me just one misdemeanor and some probation. So when I went then to work in the doctor's office and started calling prescriptions in for myself, and when I was caught doing that some months later, then I was charged with 9 felonies. One of the felonies stuck, so now I'm a felon, and I had to serve the remainder of the sentence from my first offense that I was put on probation for. So that's where the 4 months came in. So it was two separate cases, and then I was on probation again for another 3 years, which I completed without any problem once I was in recovery. It's hard to do well in probation when you're using.
Okay, when you went into, let's back up one more thing. I was going to ask a different question and change my mind. So what, I guess, as you went through this, what in your mind made you say, oh, I'm not going to get caught? I mean, you said that you thought that through the whole thing. You know, I know now there's more cameras around hospitals and clinics and things like that than around cabinets where medicine is dispensed or medication. But, you know, at that point, there may or may not have been any of that around, but what was going through your head, if you can remember, back then?
Yes, I remember it very clearly, actually. We didn't have the big fancy machines they have now. They're called Pixits or whatever they're called. We didn't have those then. We simply had stuff in a lockbox, and we had to count it every shift. And, you know, it's very difficult to just take something if you're, it's not all that difficult. But so what I would do, again, I just was in complete denial. So sometimes I would take a medication and then tell another nurse, oh, I had to waste this med. Will you co-sign for me? And I would have someone co-sign it. So in other words, if a patient had an order for 10 milligrams of morphine, I would take the 10 milligrams. Whether or not they needed it, I would take it out. And if they didn't need any, I would take it all and just have a nurse co-sign, you know, say I gave them some and co-sign for me. So that's what we would have to do. If we ever wasted any medication, we had to have another nurse co-sign. Well, nobody ever, you know, insisted on watching you waste it. They just believed you and trusted that you would, we all did that, you know, that you would sign it. I hope that people are more particular about that these days. But and so I would do that often. And when drugs would expire, we would have to waste them, take those, and just tell people, oh, here, I had to waste this because it was out of date. Then once I progressed and was, you know, towards the end, I was actually altering drug counts, like previous drug counts, so that it would look like it wasn't missing. I don't know if that makes sense. But so like yesterday we counted and there were 5. Now, if I take one, there's only going to be 4. So I would change yesterday's record to 4 so it wouldn't look like any was missing. But I would sign, like, the one time I signed it, like, they showed me this after. I had no memory, really, of doing it, a vague memory. But I changed it from black pen with a blue pen, so it wasn't even an accurate change. Nobody in their right mind would think anybody would believe that record. So my whole point is, I was not in my right mind, and I was not thinking correctly. I had myself completely convinced that nobody was even looking at me. Nobody cared. It wasn't going to be an issue. I could do whatever, and they wouldn't notice. But of course they noticed. They noticed. And so once I was far enough along that was my thinking, it didn't take long for them to figure that out.
Okay, so now I can jump into the question I was going to. Then, you know, I just spent all the time in jail. You did that. What resources, you said you were in recovery, what resources did you have that allowed you to change that thinking? Sometimes they call it stinking thinking. And come to the reality of, hey, this isn't going to work anymore for me.
Yeah, well, jail did that for me. that first night that I was there, because for the first, my first event, I, like you said, I was just there over, it wasn't even the whole night, it was like half of the night. So the second time I got arrested, after calling in the prescriptions from the doctor's office, I had to stay overnight. And, I mean, they had me change into the, you know, jail uniform, which is like scrubs. They had me change into that, and they actually put me in the, this was at the Milwaukee County Jail, took me up to the pod and put me in a cell and closed the door. And when they closed the door, I just lost it. I cried uncontrollably and for hours. And it was in that time that I told God, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. Sorry. It's always very emotional to me. And I just gave it to him and I said, please just take it because I can't do it. And I'm not going to say that after that I felt great because I spent the next 4 months incarcerated. But after that, my head at least began to clear. I got all of the, you know, 12-step material I could get in jail and read everything I could. I went to 12-step meetings in jail, because they do bring meetings into jail once a week or so. I went to the chapel that they have, you know, a few times a week, every chance I got. And I really prayed. And I said, I want to do whatever it is I need to do to be sober. And, you know, I was there, 4 months felt like an eternity to me. It doesn't sound like a lot to those who have done, you know, more time than that, but it was an eternity to me. But I believe it was the amount of time that I needed to clear my head so that when I got out, I would be able to stick with recovery, which is what I did. I got out. My sponsor picked me up, went to a meeting that night, and have been to meetings. I still go to meetings, and I believe I will continue to go to meetings for as long as I want to stay sober. That's kind of a long answer to your question, but that's where it started in jail. I just didn't ever want to have to go back there again. I didn't ever want to feel the emptiness that I felt without my girl. I didn't see my younger daughter, who turned 5 while I was there, for 4 months because her dad wouldn't bring her, and I don't blame him for that. But I didn't get to see her for 4 months, again, an eternity when your daughter is 4 entering 5. So I didn't want to go through it, and I didn't want them to have to go through anything like that again.
Okay. So that resolved or helped you come to recovery for both the drugs and the alcohol at that point?
Yes. Yep. I knew that once I took a drink, then I wanted pills. It just didn't, one led to the other. It didn't matter. Whatever substance altered my mind, led to my true passion. Passion isn't the right word, but my true addiction is opiates. Like, that's the one that killed me. Alcohol, I loved alcohol very much, but it led to the pills. I preferred the pills because I could function when I took them. I could go to work. I couldn't go to work drunk. People would smell it. You'd slur your words and all that. With the pills, I knew how much I could take, at least in my own mind, so that nobody would notice. I can't drink alcohol. I'm an alcoholic as well, but it leads to worse things for me.
So you've come through this now. How do you avoid if somebody offers you something at this point? Is it something
I get offered, not drugs. I don't hang around with people that use drugs, you know, recreationally. But people offer me alcohol if we're out to dinner. Last night, actually, I went to a bar grill for someone's birthday party from work. And I'm offered alcohol, but I have no desire for it, so I just turn it down. For me, the addiction was so strong that I couldn't say no to it. So when I was not in recovery, if someone offered me a drink, I drank it, even if I wasn't supposed to be. now God has released me of that compulsion to drink and to use, so that if somebody offers me something, I don't want it. I think part of that is because the pain of jail was so strong that my mind knows, because it's not always, you know, physically, it's just subconsciously, my mind knows that that is death for me, that alcohol. I had surgery, and I did have to take some narcotics. I don't remember which ones I took back in 2005, like after I was 9 months sober. But I was in recovery, and so my sister held the medication. I only took one, only took it when I absolutely needed it, and only for a day, and then I was able to just take Tylenol. So it's just a whole different mentality now, because everything that I do is based in recovery. So that when I am challenged, I have the tools I need to say, no, I don't need that. I have the strength, because it doesn't come from me. I have the strength to say, no, thank you. No, I don't drink. You know, what can I say to somebody? Go to a meeting and build up the strength so that when you are tempted, when somebody does offer you, you can say no. No, thank you. And move on.
Okay. So that's what you can offer as suggestions to the individual. What, you know, we've known of this opiate. It's become an epidemic. You know, there's so many people that are addicted to it. So much access to getting it. You know, people go into counseling. You know, they get the drugs. They get what they need. They can stay on them for, you know, it doesn't seem like there is really a timeline, you know, expectation for people to get off of them. What can we do societally to, you know, kind of break this chain that started?
Well, I think it needs to start with not starting it to begin with. Because once you're in the throes of addiction, stopping is very hard. So we need to look at our prescribing practices as a healthcare profession. We need to look at alternatives to pain management, because there are other things that you can do for pain rather than take narcotics. And I think that's where it needs to start. It needs to start with people limiting the amount of exposure folks have to narcotics. The problem isn't going to go away. I'm sure that it will always be here, just like marijuana use and cocaine and all the other drugs. But I think it's in such an explosion right now because there has been an explosion in prescribing. Part of that is pill mills and people, you know, reprehensible doctors and other prescribers running, you know, shops to basically their drug dealers, you know, to go in and just get your pills. Those have really exploded. Now I think the government is cracking down on those, but again, it's hard to do. It's not easy. But we need to change our mentality as well, that we don't always get to be pain-free. Sometimes we're going to have pain, and I'm not suggesting people should live in horrible pain. That's not my, I don't want people to be in bad pain, but sometimes things hurt. Sometimes you throw your back out and it hurts for a few days, as long as it's not something that requires surgery or that kind of thing. Sometimes you can get through that without needing narcotics, because narcotics don't even really make that much better. We as a society need to stop being so dependent on pain-free healthcare. Like, let's, you know, accept the fact that something might hurt for a little while. So, I mean, those are just a couple of things. I think we definitely need more addiction help, like resources, instead of jail. It would be great if you could have more treatment options, because they're not enough. There are not enough places for people to go to get clean. They go and they're kicked out after a couple of days. Kicked out, and they go right back to using again because that's all they know. They haven't been given the tools yet to stay in recovery. But I think there's a lot we can do as a society. But you're right, Cindy. The individual needs to take responsibility for their own recovery. Nobody can get you sober. Nobody can give you, you know, the the strength to get up off your knees and go forward without drugs and alcohol. But you don't have to do it alone. There are so many people that are willing to help, not only in 12-step meetings, but if you look online, they're just all over. There are resources everywhere. But you have to take the initiative to do it. You can't just, like I did, I can do this, I'm independent, I'm stubborn, I can do it all myself. You have to get help with it. It doesn't work otherwise.
You know, there are non-users out there that say, you know, I don't understand this. How come they just can't stop? How come, you know, if you're in jail, what do you mean you can't figure it out and stop doing that? Wouldn't that be the impetus? But for some people that don't use the drugs or the alcohol or don't understand how that can grab onto you, you know, they don't have the personality that does that to them. What can the non-user do, if anything, to try to break this societal epidemic or even, you know, someone they know that probably could be using treatment at this point? I know it goes from one to the, you know, one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
Any suggestions that you have?
Yeah.
And that question comes out of our chat room, too, by the way. You know.
I think that families and friends, although often or most times mean very well, they enable the addict to continue by giving them money, a place to stay, and sometimes you just need to let them know that you will support them in whatever way you can emotionally, but no more can you support them financially. There's a family I was working with that was buying groceries for their daughter, and the daughter then was using the money she'd buy groceries with to buy drugs. So, in essence, they were helping her to buy drugs. You just can't give them any financial money because if they're not ready for recovery, they're going to use that to further their addiction. So, one of the best things that a family member can do is to join a group, a 12-step group like Al-Anon, in order to understand the ways that they can help without enabling and to get some support for themselves, because addiction hurts everybody, the addict, not just the addict, but their, like you said, their family and their friends, employers. You know, for me, what about my patients who, you know, I didn't obviously take as good a care of as I could have. It's so important to get help for yourself as a family or a friend and make sure that you have your head on right so that you can do your best to help them and not, you know, enable them to further their addiction.
That makes a lot of sense in that. And so, great. You know, it seems like non-users sometimes, you know, get all, I don't want to stereotype them, but, you know, get on a pedestal and say, I don't understand. So thank you for kind of working with that a little bit. So now, in all of this, you came through your recovery. You said your counselor said, hey, you've been going through this. Why don't you turn it into a book? And that is called The Unlikely Addict. I know you've also are working with a blog, I think, of the same name. Is that correct?
Yes, it's blog.
And Unlikely Addict, excuse me. And wrong title on that. And then, so now, what would you like to share about that in just a summary? What is that allowing you to do as far as serving your purpose by having that book out and the blogs?
Yeah, well, my main purpose now in my life is just getting the word out there that opiate addiction is just overwhelming the country right now, which I think people are starting to understand, and then help people to know where to turn when they're ready to get help. So my blog, my website, unlikelyaddict.com, has resources where you can go to get help. And my blog, so blog.unlikelyag.com, talks about ways that mainly healthcare workers, the public needs to know about healthcare and healthcare workers that are using, and what we can do as a society to help that problem. I sponsor people in my 12-step meetings. I take a meeting into a prison because that was so helpful to me when I was there. And I stay open to talking about my problem and my issues and continuing to help that conversation keep going so that we can help each other to hopefully help this opiate epidemic to, if not be eradicated, at least be put a cork in it, I guess, so to speak.
Okay. So I'm just going to jump on here and tell people, if you are listening and have questions, comments, whatever, probably should have done a little bit ago, but dial in the 347-205-9074, 347-205-9074. You can Skype in, you can jump into the chat room and list your comments if you have some. So we did have a couple of questions coming out of that. Hopefully people do that in the next few moments as we're kind of out of our part of sharing and questioning for this. Jane, did you have anything you wanted to add into this or comments?
The only other thing I would ask generically of you, Kristen, is to ask, so your purpose has been very specific. Other people's might be very specific to their circumstances. What would you say to them about finding and following their purpose? What encouragement would you give them?
Well, I think some of the most difficult events of our life turn out to be those that lead us to our purpose. So if you are in a difficult spot right now, just know that perhaps this is what you need in order for your purpose to become known. Because I sure didn't know this was going to be my purpose 13 years ago, but I'm very grateful for it now. I feel like I help people every once in a while. And that's a really good feeling, and it's a good place to be in. But I never would have guessed that 13 years ago. I thought everything was over. So even though you have a difficult situation, that may lead you to your purpose. So maybe just be open to that.
So be open to the opportunities and the struggle.
Right, right.
Well, thank you so much. I think Cindy's going to talk a little bit first, see if there's any calls for us, or for you specifically, and then talk a little bit about what we're going to do in the next few weeks.
Cool. Well, yes, thank you, Kristen, for being a part of this. I do want to make sure that anyone who does listen to this archived comes on over to Facebook Purpose Talk Radio Conversations group, and I'm going to put you in that, Kristen, so that you can see if there's any comments, questions, feedback over the week. For people that might have something to ask you as they listen to the show archived or, you know, whenever that might have come about. And it just look for the one that's posted for today with today's date on it. And we'll go from that. Otherwise, people can send in emails if they want it as well, and we could pass that on to you. For emailing, you can email at Cindy, C-I-N-D-Y, at PurposeTalkRadio.com. PURPOSETALKRADIO.com. Or I would presume they could send you messages directly, Kristen, or however you would like to have people contact you. Is there any way you'd like that to happen? Or how can they reach you?
Sure. So they can either reach me through my website, unlikelyaddict.com. There is a contact me page. Or you can email me. It's theweights1000@yahoo.com. theweights1000@yahoo.com.
Okay. And where is your book available? Is it on Amazon or where can you get that?
Yes, it's on Amazon. And you can get a hard copy book or you can get a Kindle edition.
Okay, and feel free to put that into the Purpose Talk Radio Conversations thread, too, if you'd like, for your contact information. And I think so. I'm not seeing any callers in here, so we will put you back on hold as we finish this and probably let you get back to work for your day. And was there any other final comments or things that you think we might have missed?
Not that I can think of. I appreciate you opening up to this conversation because that's really an important one.
Great. Thank you very much. Have a great afternoon, then.
You too. Thank you.
All right, folks. So you just heard from Kristen Labatt on the overcoming opiate addiction and some of her struggles and her challenges. Now, next week, we want to do something a little bit different. So, you know, we're looking for particular people from the audience, friends, family, you know, that might want to be a part of this. It just so happens that we have Good Friday and Passover landing on the Friday of the show. Now, for many people in the world, that is considered sacred holidays. We're looking for people that might be interested in speaking to how the spirituality of that day impacts the rest of their life and their purpose for life. Because for some people, various spiritual aspects do tend to guide their life. For folks that don't have a spiritual practice, it's another day, and in some cases, they do just the opposite of what those that find that day important might do. So we're looking for folks that are Christian, Jewish, atheist, Buddhist, agnostic, a variety of spiritual practices that might be interested in talking about that. If you would be willing and able to do that, please do get a hold of me through the email. Again, that would be Cindy at PurposeTalkRadio.com. Cindy at PurposeTalkRadio.com. We are looking into after that, you know, anytime you want to be a guest on the show to talk about your purpose, how you came to know it, how you came to achieve it, suggestions you have for others, send me an email also. We've got a couple spots open into later April and into May that we're looking to fill. We've got the first parts of April filled. Which is good that we have some things going forward. We always have our first Friday scheduled. And we'll let Jane talk on that because that's been her baby, so I'm going to let her talk on that one.
And this first Friday, we're going to have Cindy talk and actually do a meditation with us. And that idea of whether you already have your purpose or you need to reconnect and rediscover your purpose. So as we talk about Purpose Talk Radio, sometimes it's taking that stillness and reconnecting and finding that purpose. So we're going to have Cindy lead us in a meditation on our first Friday in April. And again, this is Jane DeGeorge, and my purpose, I have a message for you.net. is how you can reach me, and I am a psychic medium, and I do readings for folks. Cindy?
Thank you. Outside of Purpose Talk Radio, I am an editor, writer, musician, songwriter, do a couple of different things. You can reach me through my Facebook pages. You can also find me on Twitter under the name of Cindy Freeman. And see the writing on that and the editing on SoundNet. I have a couple of Facebook pages. Also a travel agent. And you can reach me through that one at truevisionstravel.com. The website is truevisionsmedia.org, where I have a lot of my photography, some of the information about editing and writing in that as well. As far as the songwriting is concerned, as I said, the theme song for Purpose Talk Radio is I Am Who I Am, and I am a part of the co-write on that, along with the vocalist Jillian Clark and Rachel Grace. And so until next week, we wish you all soul blessings. Oh, no, I'm sorry, one more thing. We have to do an affirmation for the week, and I think Jane had kind of already said it, that I am being open to
all opportunities. Let's do it. I'm being open to all opportunities for recovery, because I do believe that in all of our lives there is something that we are recovering from, whether it is a trauma or a drama, someone else hurting us, us hurting them. I think I started in a church that said that, and I seem to believe it. You know, we're all recovering from something. It may be very simple. It may be very dramatic to us. So I think our affirmation is today is I am open to all opportunities for recovery, and making that very simple. So now I say, as we end the song with the show with I Am Who I Am by the Group True Trinity, we wish you all soul blessings and thank you for listening.
I am me, I am who I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. I am me, I am who I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny.